morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking with Thomas Larson, the author of The Memoir and the Memoirist, Reading and Writing Personal Narrative. And we're going to be speaking to the great political cartoonist, Pat Oliphant. Right now, by telephone, I would like to welcome Sarah Parker. She will be moderating a roundtable discussion this Saturday morning, October 27th, and it's a conversation among farmers, ranchers, and scholars discussing the connection between land and culture in New Mexico. And this will be at Northern New Mexico College Theater. Admission is free, and it's in partnership with Sostenga, the Center for Sustainable Food, Agriculture, and Environment in Northern New Mexico. Welcome, Sarah.
Hello, thank you.
What are some of the ways in which land use has changed in northern New Mexico in the last half century or so?
Well, there's a lot more people moving in. People have had to start working 9-to-5 jobs. They've had to leave their homes in order to survive. So a lot has changed. I mean, land transfers are going from agriculture to development. And right now, because the state is seeing so much growth, it's really, you know, things are really changing.
So what happens to the people whose land was once farmland is now being developed? Where do they go?
You know, it depends. I mean, some people sell their land in order to send their children to college, because there's no other way. And land prices have gone up so much that it's hard not to. Some people have just had to move out of the area because they can't afford to. If somebody dies, they can't afford the estate taxes. They can't afford to pay what it's worth now, because there's just been so much speculation and so much, you know, we value the land on the beauty and the, you know, seeing the mountains rather than what the land actually gives us. So, and it's hard for a farmer to make it because the prices are so high.
What happens to the knowledge that is centuries old, and in the case of Native Americans, millennia old, when the land gets transferred?
Well, I mean, you know, a lot of people, that's what a lot of people are fighting for right now. They don't want to lose that. They want to, you know, when we lose it, it's gone. People here, this is a really special place because people still remember how to take care of themselves and how to live with the land. And it's not that case in other parts of the country. They talk about, in some of the interviews that I've done for the radio program that this is attached to, people talk about how, you know, during the Depression, nobody was affected here because they were self-sufficient, and it was the same as it ever was. So, you know, people are really working to keep that knowledge and keep that. But it's, you know, the harder it gets to stay on the land, the fewer people are going to actually be able to. So that knowledge is going to disappear.
I mean, ironically, what would probably cause it to not disappear would be another Great Depression.
Right. Then people actually have to live with it again. And a lot of people still do, you know, but it's harder and harder. So,
is there a vision that includes the melding of modern and traditional agriculture? Is that something that you are seeing or working on?
Well, I guess. I mean, you know, I talked to a lot of farmers and ranchers all over the state, and, you know, there's a type of ranching, and I can't remember what it's called right now, but it's more holistic, and it looks at how the buffalo managed the land. So they don't, you know, it's not like what we think of as traditional ranching where you know, you put your cows out at, or your cattle, your whatever your
livestock,
working with your livestock, putting it out in one pasture for a long period of time. I mean, it's they really move them around to small sections. I don't know, it's just, you know, people are trying to put more traditional things in. I mean, actually, very traditional things rather than, you know, from the last 50, 60, 70 years.
We're talking to Sarah Parker, and her website is called theshiftofland.org. So tell us about your project. I mean, you're doing this roundtable discussion, but it's part of a much larger project that you're engaged in.
Right. The project is actually, it's a 13-part radio series, and it's focusing on, you know, just looking at the connection between land and culture, to remember that, because I think that a lot of times we forget, especially if we're living in cities, we forget that there is that connection between the land and our culture. So I went all over the state and I spoke with farmers, scholars, and ranchers about that connection and about what they see coming into the state. There's a lot going on nationally and globally. Things that are, you know, genetically engineered seeds. There's a lot of water transfers, a lot of land transfers. I mean, that's just in the state, you know, but it's happening all over the world. So talking to people about what's coming in and how that, what that means for culture in New Mexico, because that's why, you know, that's, it's kind of a paradox, because people are moving into the state because it's so beautiful and they love the culture and, you know, but all of, you know, there's so much development and all of that development is changing things. We really have to, it's happening all over the country, the development. So it's just, it's something that we really have to look at and to see how to do things in a good way so that we're not actually hurting things.
Are there models of that that you've seen either in New Mexico or elsewhere of how to do development, how to deal with a growing population and so on, that, that is not hurtful of local culture?
No, I mean, I spoke with some Peter Vigil from the Taos Soil and Water Conservation District, and he talked a lot about it. He talked about, you know, just people are, there's a model in Albuquerque, and I can't remember the name of it right now, I apologize, but it's just, it's having open space, and it's having fewer curbs and gutters. It's, you know, just trying to minimize the impact that we make on the land, but keeping those open spaces, because we need that. We need land that we can grow things on. We need land to absorb the rain, you know. So those are...
Right, right. What are some of the specific cultural aspects that you are touching on in your radio, your 13-part radio series?
Well, people talk about the sakias. They talk about rural culture. They talk about the food. People, almost everyone talks about the food, the chilies. The Esteban Arellano talks about the different seeds that came over with the Spanish from Europe and the Mediterranean, from Mexico, that came up here, and the mixing that that made and how that really made New Mexican cuisine. And it's not, you know, people talk about that, about the food a lot. They, you know, that seems to be our most basic connection to the land. And just, yeah, the acequias, the tradition that people have and want to maintain.
So this Saturday morning from 9 to 12 at Northern New Mexico College Theater, there's going to be a free event with a lot of people speaking. I mean, you've got journalists, tradition bearers, farmers, Native American, Hispanic, all sorts of people. And you're guiding the conversation. What is the topic? What are you going to really focus on?
We'll focus on what the radio program focuses on, the connection between land and culture and agriculture and what's coming into the state from national trends and global trends and what it means for the state, what some alternatives are. Because somebody from Christina Armstrong Trujillo from Taos Land Trust will be there, and she'll talk about some of the alternatives to protecting, how you can protect your land. People from the Taos County Economic Development Center, Terry Badhand and Patty Martinson, will be there to talk about what you can do for a sustainable local food economy. And everyone, you know, we'll just talk about the alternatives and what we can do to maintain things here.
Well, Sarah Parker, thank you so much for being with us on KSFR.
Thank you very much.
Sarah Parker's website is called theshiftofland.org, and once again, the event is on the 27th of October, and if people would like, that's this Saturday from 9 to 12, and if people would like more information, they can call 699-4064. We're going to take a little break right now, and when we come back, we'll be speaking about memoir writing. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to introduce Thomas Larson. He is the author of the book, The Memoir and the Memoirist, Reading and Writing Personal Narrative, and he will be leading giving a lecture and leading a workshop called Finding Ourselves, Writing Memoir and the Process of Individuation. The lecture is on Friday night at 6:30. The workshop is on Saturday from 9:30 to 11:30 in the morning. Welcome.
Good morning.
It's great to have you here. First of all, let's start with the big question. What is a memoir as opposed to an autobiography?
Well, a memoir is a work of literature that focuses on the meaning and intensity of a singular relationship in the author's life. And the word singular is most important because traditionally life writing, personal narrative, had been done as autobiography, which is to say you write about the entire life from birth to last night. It's a life that's already been lived and processed and understood. And these kinds of books were written by public people, statesmen, politicians, of course, the famous, the celebrities, the notorious, and so on.
Now, you don't think that they are engaged in processing their lives while they write their autobiographies?
No, they're not. And that's what happens when you read them. Virginia Woolf wrote a wonderful essay back in the late 1930s about this very thing, in which she talked about the problem with reading autobiographies is they concentrated on what is remembered rather than who is remembering. And they left out the person, she said, to whom things happened. And that person is what I would call a relationship between the public individual and the private self. Mostly autobiographies up until 20 years ago. And of course, these books are still being written and published. But their focus was a summary of a life. It was not intimate. It was not meant to be revelatory or emotional or really go into the kinds of depths which we expect of our revealers, in whether they're on television or in the book world.
So memoir, in contrast, does something which is more self-revelatory, is more focused on the writer, who's the rememberer, the person who's doing the remembering.
Absolutely, it is a book which, first of all, needs a subject. A writer needs, because the life is not the subject, it's some aspect of the life. It could be a divorce, it could be childhood, it could be a year at law school, it could be something recent, it could be something long ago, or increasingly we're seeing memoirs written now which are stories of some aspect of the life that's being lived as it's happening.
So things that happened very recently and haven't been processed with the wisdom and distance of time.
Yeah, exactly. And a lot of listeners will know Joan Didion's book, The Year of Magical Thinking, which came out in 2006. And that book, basically, the story is her husband died one Christmas day in, I think it was 2004. About 6 months later, she began writing the story of his death. And that story was what his death was doing to her, which in essence was, as we all know, if we've had deaths of relatives or people close to us, we're completely disoriented. And she writes the book in the disorientation. It's not a journal. It's not a scrawling of feelings and emotions. She's genuinely trying to figure out what is happening to her, how reality is sort of, how she is twisting the very real things and aspects of grief. And it's a very powerful book, and it really sort of brought the memoir into the current age, because Didion is, of course, a noted American writer who's written fiction and essays and so on, and this is a marvelous book to read.
Now, what's the relationship between journal writing, which lots of people do, and memoir writing?
Well, as I said, memoir is a structure. It's a literary art form. It involves...
But, I mean, what, do people draw on their journals? I mean, how do they interact?
Well, do they draw in their journals? Sure, yeah. I've been keeping a journal for some 30 years, and it's wonderful, as most writers know, to have material that you can go back to, and there are, some of the facts that you certainly have forgotten. If you're a good journal writer, you'll have that material to see. But memoir is a very focused form that wants to get at a relationship between you and whatever that subject is. So it's bounded by time, phase, individual person that you may be focused on. And it's journals are for the immediate inscription of emotion. And that's not what memoir does. Memoir has to take a step back and begin to analyze that emotion and reflect on it. And this reflective capacity that all of us have, but we underuse, and it's undervalued in our society, is one of the reasons why memoirs come to the fore. It's very much counter to the constant processing and pushing of information in our society, even though paradoxically memoir is about the present writer and the present feelings and so on. You can be reflective about the present and the recent past.
We're talking to Thomas Larson, who will be giving a talk on Friday evening and a workshop on Saturday morning. The memoir form has become popular just in the last few years, in the last, few decades, I guess.
Yeah, in the last 20 years. I date it to about 1987.
What happened? What's going on with that?
Oh, gosh, I wish I knew the simple answer to that. I try to figure it out in my book to some extent. My best guess now is that it's really been driven by two things. First is a handful of writers. Many of them novelists. I think of writers like Tobias Wolff, who wrote a book called This Boy's Life in 1987. And it was a memoir which reads like a novel. So it had this kind of, they were sort of cousins in the literary world. And there were a number of professional writers who just said, I'm not interested in writing the story of my life. I'm interested in being very specific, often writing about childhood and adolescence and the formative years. After all, probably the majority of memoir writers look at that kind of, that period and the people involved in that period in their lives as subject matter. The other thing I think happened is television and contemporary media, that we became a culture that instantly values and devalues personhood on television. And this, I think, is fascinating. The whole movement of reality television, the whole movement of revealing yourself on a Jerry Springer show and so on, that added to this door-opening juggernaut of possibility for writers, because we saw that the people we present in media are not exactly the people we are. Well, there's certainly, I hope they're not the people we are. There is more to us than what television reveals in the moment. And so memoir, simultaneously, it arises as a literary form with great potentiality for writers and for self-expression, but it also arises as a counteractive form to the falsification of personhood on television.
And so there's more scope for truth and genuine expression in the memoir form.
Yeah, there's more scope for what we call truth, which is a very difficult form, a very difficult idea to work with. I have a chapter in my book entitled "What Is Telling the Truth?" And this is something that we've been debating publicly since James Frey reminded us what the difference is between factual truth and emotional truth. Factual truth, of course, is where you change things, as he did. He was in jail not 80 days, as he claimed, but 3 days or 3 hours, as he claimed. And these are lies. These are outright falsifications. The idea of emotional truth, which is what writers are trying to get at in memoir,
Not to mention in fiction.
Well, not to mention in fiction too. Yeah, and but the interesting difference between fiction and memoir is that in fiction you have you create characters who try to get at their own emotional truths in a plot that works itself out in the fiction. In memoir, people are trying to understand the truth of their lives as it occurs or as it has recently occurred. And I'm searching right now for a section by Mary Carr, that I just wanted to read, that emotional truth in memoir has to do with the actual life itself. In other words, you're not inventing anything. You're really trying to understand what it is your parents did to you, what it is you did to your children, etc. And Mary Carr came up with this wonderful, very short little phrase about the difference between memoir and fiction. She said, "When I tried to write about my life in a novel, I discovered that I behaved better in fiction than I did in real life. The truth is that I found it easier to lie in a novel, and what I wanted most of all was to tell the truth." So that gives you a sense of the difference in the scope.
Now, one very striking thing about memoir is a lot of memoirs are written by ordinary people. It's no longer Winston Churchill and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
What makes ordinary people's lives interesting enough that anybody besides their blood relatives would want to read it?
Because the quick answer is because the story they tell is universal. One of the most important subject matters for memoir writing, and by the way, memoir can be 2 pages, it can be 200 pages, it can be 500 pages, it can be a short piece or a book. These stories are universal. I think of the majority of books are what I call relational memoirs. In other words, father-son, mother-daughter, sibling, books about siblings, and so on. And the best of these... I'm sorry, I lost my train. Remind me the question.
Of what makes ordinary people's lives
yes,
worth
good,
reading.
Thanks. The ordinary life is universal because we are all children of parents. Many of us are parents of children. Many of us are siblings. They tell stories that we all recognize. I don't recognize myself, nor would I think anyone, in the life of Winston Churchill or the life of the miner who comes out of the mine and is given a book deal to tell the story of what happened, or a Hollywood celebrity. Those books are far more pornographic in the sense of we're mere observers and watchers of it. With memoir, there is this immediate association to actual experience. And once you start reading a book which is direct and honest and heartfelt about a woman growing up in difficult circumstances in Kentucky, for example, no matter who you are or where you grew up, you resonate with her story. And this, I think, time and again, is driving what the publishing world wants. It wants stories of universal sympathy and emotion.
Now, you have these stories which are universal, which are also very specific. What makes a good memoir succeed in grabbing the attention of the readers and in drawing somebody in who has perhaps lived quite a different life? And what makes a memoir fail? I mean, you teach students. What is that thing? I mean, I can imagine that some of them are just absolutely excruciating to read, and you don't want to go through past page 3.
Yeah, and ask yourself why they're excruciating.
Well,
to
I'm asking
read.
You.
Well, it's just the question. They're bad to read because they're all about me. They do not have a subject. They do not have a clear sense of where they're going. What is this book about? Memoir is not about the I. Memoir is about our relationship to something or some person of value in our lives. And you have to it's ironic, you have to focus on the other in order to focus on myself or the self. A good example of that is a book called The Color of Water by James McBride, It's the subtitle tells you everything, A Black Man's Tribute to His White Mother. And the book alternates chapters between his perspective of what it was like to grow up in a family of 12 with a white Jewish mother, and the other chapters are her remembering herself growing up. So you get this movement back and forth between the son and the mother, and he tells his story, she tells her, and as he goes, he listens to her story, and her story sort of takes over his. You start to see that what a life really is the emotional bond between this mother and this son that he didn't know existed as deep and as full as it was until he wrote the book about it. You have to be a good writer. You have to work at this stuff. I do private memoir groups in which people take years, 4 or 5 years, to quote-unquote finish just a first draft.
Now, you talk in your book about some of the groups you've taught, and the group dynamic seems to be very, very important. Yeah. Are memoirs often written in writing groups?
Yeah, I recommend that to anybody, and whenever I do my talks or workshops, the hope is to leave them with inspiration and a kind of passion for their particular story, and also to help them get started on a network, because that network is very important. This is the writing life is a lonely life, and it's going to be even more lonely if you're writing memoir, because the focus is on the self, the past, the relationship, which seems to be boxed into your own little writing room. And people working on memoir together in a group of say 8 or 10 people give each other the emotional trust in order to tell these stories. So people go in a group, they go deeper, they go farther than they thought they would. The group encourages them to,
if the group is safe enough.
If the group is safe. But every group, every class I've been in has developed its own safety. I think we can trust people to do that. And the best part about a writing group is that there's the discipline. You have to produce every 2 weeks or every month. And after 3 years, you get 300-400 pages. And that's how you get a lot of people get a book done.
Thomas Larson, I want to thank you so much for being here. Thomas Larson is author of The Memoir and the Memoirist, Reading and Writing Personal Narrative. And he will be giving a lecture on Friday night at 6:30 and a workshop the next morning for a couple of hours called Finding Ourselves, Writing Memoir, and the Process of Individuation. It's associated with the Narrative Arts Center and the Southwest Literary Center, and it will be taking place where?
Yeah, the lecture and the workshop is at 825 Camino de Monterrey.
Okay.
And it's put on by Cine Green of the Narrative Arts Center, thanks to Cine. I'm also just a quick note that I'll be doing a week-long Writing the Memoir workshop at Ghost Ranch in Santa Fe, and that'll be next May.
And for more information on this weekend's events, you can call 988-5185, 988-5185. Thomas Larson, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
We will be taking a quick break right now. Stay tuned to KSFR. I would like now to welcome Pat Oliphant. He's an artist, political cartoonist, sculptor, winner of the Pulitzer Prize, as well as many other prizes, including the National Cartoonist Society's prestigious Rubin Award. And he will be speaking today at 5 o'clock at Garcia Street Books to launch his new book, Leadership, Oliphant Cartoons and Sculpture from the Bush Years. And that's today at Garcia Street Books. The exhibition of the artist's work will be ongoing through the 12th of November. Welcome.
Thank you.
It's wonderful to have you here as a lifelong admirer of your work. You came from Australia. You became a political cartoonist there, but very quickly you moved to the United States.
Right, 1964.
So, and you were a young man. Why the United States?
Well, in Australia, nothing much happens. So I was doing cartooning there for 11 years, and then moved to Denver in 1964 and to the Denver Post. That's how I found out about Santa Fe. And Santa Fe in those days was R&R for people.
Right.
Wanted to get out of Denver, you went to Santa Fe.
And very quickly, you became a syndicated cartoonist.
Yeah, about 2 years after I got here.
So, in order to do the kind of political cartooning you do, you get up early and read lots of newspapers, or how do you decide which issue you're going to take on in any day?
How you decide, I think, is just to keep an eye on what's going on. And you try to vary it every day. You can't keep on one subject every day, although in these days it gets more and more hard to vary it because of the political climate. But the rest is just looking at the absurdity of everything. And there's plenty of that. So.
There certainly is plenty of absurdity, but I think one of the amazing things about your cartoons is that once one sees them, it seems so obvious. Anybody should have made that joke, but you're the one who comes up with it.
I don't know if that's a compliment or not.
It is.
But I guess we're pointing out the obvious in many ways.
So another thing that your work has done is you very much put the image primary. So, for example, the cover work of your newest book is a horse with blinders on, led by Dick Cheney, holding a rifle, and a tiny little skinny George Bush as court jester riding on top, grabbing onto the mane of the horse. No comment really necessary. You pioneered this as a way of doing cartoons. Is that right?
Oh, I don't know if I did. This is how I see things. The horse, the great big draft horse, I'm sort of partial to those sort of horses. And at first I thought that it was the press, because the press had been giving these people a free ride for so long. And then I thought, no, it's the country. And there's Cheney with a shotgun, by the way, if you remember the incident.
Right, right.
And a little Bush up on top on the horse being led by Cheney. And the whole country being led by Cheney. This book itself is also serves as an exhibit. It's a catalog of stuff that is in a traveling show, which is opening in Charlotte, in Savannah, I'm sorry, in February, and then it moves on to other places. But it's called Leadership, which is meant in full irony, and it's got three new sculptures in it. One of which is just like the cover, and then one inside here, which is
Billy,
just inside
Bill
the front
Clinton
page.
As Billy the Kid.
Oh yeah, we've got that. But that's the one. That's the other one. The Rumsfeld. Rumsfeld is a he makes a very good Prussian general, actually, with a spike on his helmet, and that. We're showing those just tonight, anyway, at Garcia Street Books. We're having a signing there, and I'm glad you said that I was giving a talk, because I didn't know that. That comes as a surprise. I better prepare something.
Well, maybe you're not.
Well, it was just signing books.
Let's see. Launch. It says book launch, so I suppose you'll do whatever you want to do. But, I mean, you've been observing politics for decade after decade, and
I've been doing this for 53 years now.
And every day there's something to make cartoons about. Every day there's something to get angry about. Do you still feel that passion after doing it for so long?
Oh yes, but it's hard to lose that. In fact, that's another reason. Pardon me. Why I came here, because everything's going on here. They've never let me down.
You mean the United States?
Right. And politicians in general.
Right. In other words, if everybody were peaceful and there were a philosopher king leading a country through a period of long-term peace and tranquility...
Well, that's what Australia's like in many ways.
You wouldn't have a...
and Shangri-La will drive you crazy.
If you're a cartoonist.
Yeah. So you have to be where things are happening.
But the passion still is as intense as it always was, and that sense of outrage.
And bring yourself to a boil at least once a day.
Yeah, you've been quoted
saying
that.
Pretty easy these days. Pretty easy. I think the most tranquil we had was Ford after Nixon, and then Jimmy Carter.
Now, you always portrayed Ford with a Band-Aid on his head.
Yes, I did. And I explained that in the book, too.
Right.
And it actually happened. I was asked to, I suppose, be the entertainment for this gathering of Republicans. I don't know why, but Gerald Ford himself called me up one day, which I thought was very nice, thank you, and asked me if I would do a talk and draw at the same time, which I did. Not being kind to Republicans at all, but they took it very well. And at that time, I had been drawing Ford with the Band-Aid on his head because he used to fall down the stairs. He used to fall upstairs and bang his head on helicopters and so on. So I had drawn him that evening with his Band-Aid on, and I crossed the room, I don't know why, and with a piece of charcoal in my hand and drew it on him himself.
On the actual Gerald Ford, you drew a Band-Aid on his head.
That's the first president I've drawn on, probably the last.
Now, having observed politics for as long as you have and being very much in the public eye in hundreds of newspapers all around the world, you've been called a very influential cartoonist, the most influential cartoonist. How do you see the nature of that influence?
I don't really dwell on it. I just do what I do really for myself every day. And if that's true, that's very flattering. But,
do you know, I mean, do you get feedback from people about how something has changed their opinions or made them see things differently?
I don't think you change people's opinions. You're able to express your own and start a conversation, I think, is about all you can expect. But, I never saw really any influence of changing people onto another track.
Looking at the Bush years, as you do in this book, Leadership, quote-unquote leadership, you were very hard on the, I think with great reason, on both the Republicans and the Democrats. What is wrong with each group, in your view?
Well, I don't know. There's just so much blame. There's plenty of blame to go around. You know, there's enough shenanigans in both parties. I think a politician is a politician, and they're very much the same on both sides.
Are they? I mean, you, for example, have cartoon where the Democrats are each checking their brains in glass jars before they go into Congress, or another cartoon of Democrats as a little cowed, skinny, you know, barnyard dog.
Yeah, I had them hanging up their backbones too one day.
Right.
And before they sort of collapsed into jellied heaps and walked into the house. But, that's how I feel about them.
Whereas the Republicans are certainly not checking their brains or backbones, but your little, what does your little penguin say about them? They don't have to, they have no shame.
Well, he gets me in all sorts of trouble.
Now tell us about the little penguin in the corner.
Well, I worked for a very conservative newspaper in Australia, in Adelaide, Australia. The opposition paper was Rupert Murdoch's, this is all incidental, Rupert Murdoch's first newspaper, which was called The News. And the echoes of that still stay on, and the name of his corporation, which is the News Corporation. And this newspaper was the conservative. He played himself as the liberal paper, and which is a funny thing. And I had a bunch of editors I had to meet with every day, which was just a terrible experience. Because they'd all come back from their clubs and they'd be full of claret, and I had to present my cartoon to these people. It was just difficult. These are my first years in cartooning.
So they were trying to edit your cartoons and say, don't do this.
They were trying to write everything for me, draw it for me and everything. And so in order to get my own opinions and my own cartoons, I invented this little fella as an aside. And everybody liked him. So before they realized what was happening, he was there and he stayed. He's been there ever since. I always think that he maybe invented me. I didn't invent him.
How did you deal with it when they tried to rewrite your cartoons?
Go crazy. Swore I was going to get out of there, and I did, eventually. But it slowed down after a while, but I still was discontent with the place. So.
Now, you were sent, actually, on a world tour to study cartoons.
Yeah, they were very paternalistic in that way. They would send all sorts of people overseas to... They realized the value of that travel broadened you. So I came through the United States on that trip, and at that time decided I got to come back here. This is where it's happening. Of course, now it happens all over the world, but in those days there was the civil rights and there was all sorts of stuff. The Vietnam War was just starting up. And women's movement and everything. So there was plenty to work with.
How close did you get to the issues that you were drawing cartoons about? Was this something you could do sitting in your chair anywhere, or were you...
As long as I have the news. And really can... I guess I can do it anywhere. And technology today, you certainly can. So I... draw it in the morning, every morning. Scan it through the computer, send it by email to the syndicate. They redistribute it, and it can be seen the next morning. It used to be that we were at the mercy of the mails, can you imagine?
And couriers.
And couriers, yeah. Courier to a printer. The printer would print it, and then it would be stuffed in envelopes and left in the great maw of the U.S. mail. That might get there in 5 days, may not.
Did you ever, being as politically aware as you by necessity are doing the work you do, did you ever participate in other ways in political activities of the day?
You mean, did I...
Marching on Washington?
Oh, no, I didn't do that. No, I do my own marching in my own way. I could say that I vote every day, too. But I can't lend myself to supporting any one political figure, even though I believe they're doing the right thing. I can't lean in any one direction.
When you say you believe in doing the right thing, how do you define the right thing, and who do you see, if anybody, doing the right thing?
It's easy to see the wrong thing.
Indeed.
So I guess if you can see that, then you can see the other thing. It's all an interpretation, really. It's what I think. Maybe right, maybe wrong. No, of course I'm right. So that's how that goes.
Why did you make a sculpture of Lyndon Johnson as a centaur?
Well, he had a certain reputation. A well-equipped centaur. And there are people in Texas with a sense of humor down in Austin who would like to see that done a little bit larger than life-size and put out somewhere near the airport.
And Bill Clinton as Billy the Kid.
Well, you know, he was tended to be a kid about things, big kid about things. And, Because the only image we have of Billy the Kid is the one that that I copied here. It's a photograph of him leaning on his rifle, with his, wearing his holster. I moved the holster a little. But, I'll have that on display at Garcia Street.
How big are your sculptures?
Oh, they're tabletop things. Nothing you couldn't put on the tabletop.
Okay.
The Rumsfeld would be about 20 inches high, I suppose. You wouldn't want that on the tabletop.
I think not. One of the cartoons I loved was a representation of the Wall Street Journal once Rupert Murdoch got his hands on it.
Oh, my God, yes.
What did you think of that entire...
He's not going to stop there. He's going to take over CNBC and everything else. What I wonder about with that, I've always wondered with Rupert, is when is enough enough? I don't know. I don't understand how greed works that way. It's never enough. And it's a very good reason why people don't live forever.
Yeah, I have often wondered what things people felt they wanted to buy once they had $1 billion that they couldn't buy when they had $5 million.
Exactly. But that's human nature. That's what makes this job fun.
We're talking to Pat Oliphant, political cartoonist, who will be at Garcia Street Books tonight at 5 o'clock to launch his new book, Leadership, Oliphant Cartoons and Sculpture from the Bush Years. And the exhibition there will run through the 12th of November. You talk about the press giving a free ride to politicians. Does it do so selectively? I mean, it seems to me that the press gives a free ride to conservatives more than liberals. What's your perception on that?
Well, the conservatives would say the New York Times gives the liberals a free ride.
They would say that, but what's your perspective?
No, I don't think so. I think that that's my opinion. I think that they call it, the conservatives call it fair and balanced, and there's nothing fair or balanced about any of the things they do, in my opinion. Conservatives get a free ride from Rupert's papers, and Washington Times, and those other. And I get very impatient with the Wall Street Journal, too.
Whereas Democrats, are they? Do they get a free ride from anybody?
Do Democrats get a free ride? I don't. I think they just take a free ride. Really, that's.
I mean, there was that joke of during the Clinton presidency where Clinton takes the Pope rowing in a rowboat on Central Park, and the Pope's big Pope hat blows off, and Clinton walks on the water and retrieves his Pope hat and puts it back on his head. And the next day, the New York Times said, "President can't swim."
That's good. I hadn't heard that.
Yeah.
Perhaps I can use it if you didn't broadcast it. Cleaning up old jokes is a,
well,
sometimes works.
Indeed it does, for those of us who tell jokes. Well, I mean, so what do you think when you look at the real mess that the country is in? I mean, one of your cartoons shows little George Bush throwing the keys to his daddy, sitting in an armchair and saying, "Daddy, I totaled the country." How do you see democracy? I mean, what is, if any, the power of the citizenry at this point?
Well, the citizenry disappoints you at the moment. It's, back in the 70s, people in the 60s, people have been out in the street throwing things. But that's because we had a draft. If we had a draft now, probably the same thing would be happening. But this, somewhere, they went to sleep. It's a little disappointing being a cartoonist in these days because it's hard to rouse things up anymore. Because people are not reading, not paying attention. You talk about politics being local, it's very local these days. The big picture is not paid attention to.
Well, Pat Oliphant, I want to thank you for being here. I just see that we're about to run out of time. Pat Oliphant is an artist, incredible artist, political cartoonist, winner of the Pulitzer Prize and many other prizes, and he will be today at Garcia Street Books on Garcia Street in Santa Fe at 5 o'clock. Thank you so much for being here with us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at the email radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We'll see you tomorrow. Ciao.